In this episode, we are going to be talking about Stanley Kubrick's The Killing, which was released in 1956. This was his second film noir, and it's got a wonderful cast, just to name a few. It's got Sterling Hayden, Colleen Gray, Vince Edwards, and Marie Windsor. My guests today are from the Kubrick Universe podcast. They're both writers and contributor on this great podcast, Robert Castle and Mark Lentz. Gentlemen, welcome. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for asking us.
Thanks, Robert.
No, my pleasure. As I was saying, I've really been enjoying the podcast, and I was curious how you both came to be interested in Kubrick to begin with.
Well, In 1968, I saw 2001: A Space Odyssey, and I just saw it the same day as Planet of the Apes, and got in, I guess the film never left me. I've been working on that film and writing about it for about 50 years, and my intellectual development sort of parallels my understanding or developing understanding of the film. And from there, it wasn't until 1980s that I began my interest in Kubrick, sort of crystallized into really trying to understand his films. And I think the first film I really dealt with was Full Metal Jacket. Mm. A friend of mine and I wrote an article, which was eventually published about 10 years later in Film Comment, dealing with Full Metal Jacket. And there really was no looking back after that. After that, I wrote, especially in the 2000s, wrote a lot of articles on Kubrick's films, and I have a small Kindle book with six of those articles called The Interpretive Odyssey of Stanley Kubrick, which sort of gets at part of my, I guess, thesis about Kubrick's works, which may or may not come up in regard to The Killing.
Mark, what about you?
The first Kubrick movie I loved was Dr. Strangelove, which I saw as a real little kid. And we happened to record it on a reel-to-reel tape recorder. And what I loved best, it was about the military. That's exciting to a little boy. And the music. I loved the music.
Right.
And then when I was in college in the late 70s, I had the good fortune that there was a course being taught on Kubrick. I could understand how each film built on the last one, right, until by the time it got to 2001, my mind was just blown. And since then, I guess I've just been a super fan. When The Shining came out in 1980, I saw it 12 times before it left the theaters. And then my interest, because he didn't make many movies after that, my interest was revived by this movie called Room 237.
Oh, right.
Which alerted me to the fact that there was other Kubrick nuts out there. And so I happened to be in a meetup book club, and I thought, well, I'll make a Kubrick meetup. And I did that for a couple of years. And through that, I discovered the Stanley Kubrick Appreciation Society on Facebook. And got in with the admins there, to the point where now I'm an admin. And one of the ideas we came up with was to have a podcast. And that podcast has been going on for 5 years now, and it's kind of developed into a great treasury of interviews. You know, from the beginning, we were saying a lot of these people are getting really old and we need to talk to them before they
right.
Yes, on. And sure enough, I think our first interview was with Shane Rimmer, who was the co-pilot in Dr. Strangelove.
Ah.
And he told us a lot of good stories. So that's my background. And most recently, since the pandemic, we've been doing a weekly Kubrick Zoom where we just talk about all things Kubrick. And Robert and I are regulars, of course, on that. So
That's great. How is it easy to get a lot of the guests? Because you've got so many people who have worked with him, Leon Vitelli, and I mean, it's quite incredible. I mean, was it easy to reach out and get them, or is it a bit of follow-ups?
The thing is, most everybody who worked on a Kubrick film, it was like the highlight of their career.
Right.
And they did their best work, and they kind of feel obliged if somebody asks them to talk about Kubrick.
Oh, great.
They're willing to do it because they loved the thing that they were part of. So in general, it's not hard to get people to say yes.
That's good to, that's good to know, because I was really impressed with the lineup. This of course is Kubrick's second noir. Of course, the other noir he made was Killer's Kiss. This is just such an extraordinary film that I've always really, really loved. Film noir in general, I always ask guests when they come on the first time and we're doing a film noir, what film noir means to them, because people have such a broad definition of what's noir and what's not. So what do you, Robert, to you, what does a film noir mean?
I think, I taught a couple courses, night courses on film noir. And I think fate comes in heavily. In fact, I show a film noir, the first film noir I show in this course is actually pre-Maltese Falcon. It's called You Only Live Once. To me, that's the essence, I think, of film noir. The your one is doomed, plus right. Mistakes are made. I mean, that's not the only element, but. And then you have 1944 with Murder, My Sweet, Laura, and Woman in the Window,
yeah,
and Double Indemnity. You know, again, in all those films, though I think Murder, My Sweet probably not as much, but what you have is the doomed couple or this sort of spiral that, you know, chews people up, you know. But as time goes on, I'll mention this when we get into The Killing, I think the further you get away from the Depression of World War II, the sort of darkness or the elements of the early film noir begin to fade. And I think it's a natural thing. That's why later film noir is a little different. And we'll get into that when we deal with The Killing.
What about you, Mark? What is film noir to you?
Well, I like film noir films. And I like what Robert just said about fate. I think that's why I like them. And definitely The Killing and Killer's Kiss, his film before that, are film noir. But with Kubrick, I think of them as Kubrick films rather than noir films. And that's because for me, looking at something through the filter of a genre, my mind doesn't work that way.
Right.
So I don't come up with much reward for doing that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Because this film, to me, certainly has like the classic noir elements. Like, of course, we have a femme fatale, Marie Windsor. And of course, she's someone who is totally after money and uses, you know, sex in order to do so. And, you know, that's such a classic noir, and you know, you're not really sure whether these guys are necessarily doomed. I think the style, certainly the feeling of it, the photography, in terms of the dark shadows and constantly using those lamps to like that are right in the shot and lighting the people's face. It feels like everybody's being interrogated all the time, just because of that lamp right on their face. Which I really, really love. But I agree in the sense that that's certainly not a classic noir, because it's just like a Kubrick heist film, you know. But it certainly has fallen under the category of noir by many historians and many noir lists over the years. So I'm curious, for each of you, you know, when you first saw this, how did you feel about it? And has your change, has your feelings changed about it with repeat viewings over the years?
I've sort of, I liked it immediately. I forget when I first watched it, but it's grown into my favorite Kubrick film. Mark has also mentioned that to me a lot. Because he's surprised, 2001 is the most important film, but The Killing is my favorite. I have to admit, I've watched it three times already this year, and it's a pleasurable watch. I sort of call it a prose poem, and there's a couple films like this out there, but it's the movement, the music, and even the way it's edited, you know, with the non-chronological
aspect. I love that. What about you, Mark? Has your feelings changed at all about this over the years with repeat viewings?
Yeah, so I wanted to mention the way I did first learn of Robert is I was listening to Movie Geeks United by Jamie Duvall.
That's a great podcast too.
And he interviewed Robert.
Oh,
and
wow.
Robert said The Killing was his favorite Kubrick movie, and I thought that was an audacious choice when you have all these others. So that did impress me. I first saw it, so our teacher in college, and our teacher showed us The Killing and The Asphalt Jungle back to back as a comparison. Both have Sterling Hayden.
They're definitely similar.
And at the time, I thought The Asphalt Jungle was better because it fit in with my conception of what a movie should be with the stars that were in it and how, I don't know, how it fit the rules of the genre. It fit what I was expecting, and The Killing didn't always fit what I was expecting, and parts of it are a little bit grotesque and unsettling, which bothered me at that age. But over the many years since, I've come to enjoy it greatly. Recently, I was just impressed about the technique that it uses. It's especially compared to Asphalt Jungle. The cinematographer for that one is just doing the typical things you do in any movie, but the cinematography and editing and music of The Killing are quite original, I think. So yeah, now I rate it as highly. I also like to say whatever Kubrick movie I saw last, that's my favorite Kubrick movie.
So. Yeah, you know, I liked it at first as well, but when I've seen it maybe two or three times, but this last time I thought I'm sort of where Robert's at. It's almost perhaps my favorite of his as well. I just think it was just so well done.
Kubrick plays with genres, and whether film noir is a genre or style, it seems to me if he's not playing with it, he's sort of in tune with the evolution of film noir as film noir sort of dissipates, I guess, a little, or is I don't want to say less sincere, but you know, it's typical of the later noirs to a great extent. They're a little more abstract. They're a little less have to do with people reacting, you know, out of to World War II, for instance. A lot of the criminals in World War from early noir seem to be almost PTSD victims of World War II who find meaning in becoming hired guns, for instance. I think of Neville Brand's character in DOA is sort of the highlight of that, but there's others.
Well,
so that's how I see the major difference.
You know. That's what's so fascinating about these characters is that they're not, with the exception of Hayden, no one is actually a criminal. Like, they all have regular jobs and they're all in a situation where they're desperate. You know, like the guy who's a police officer has all these debts he has to pay off. Elijah Cook Jr. is, you know, his wife is on the outs with him and he feels that he has to basically buy her love. So he's desperate for money. And I even really like who played Marvin Unger, J.C. Flippin, who is probably the most ambiguous character, because you're not really sure why he wants to do this other than that scene he has with Hayden, where he feels as though Hayden has become a son to him. And I thought maybe for him, it was more of an emotional reason to get involved in this, or some kind of thrill that he wants to be a part of because it's lacking from his life. I mean, you know so little about him, which I really enjoyed. Everybody's so human. Everyone, you empathize with everyone. It's just the power of cinema in general is that make you empathize with people who are doing something wrong, who are stealing, who are basically entering into crime. And even in that, you know, I'm all spoilers here. There's no, we don't have to hide what happens in a film. But of course, as we know, in the end, with that great shot where the money just blows into the wind and it's gone, and Hayden gets arrested. I mean, I feel for him. It works to such an effect that you really truly feel for these men, even, and they all die, and they all you know, or in Hayden's case, he gets caught. So I'm curious if that's also been your experience. Do you find you really empathize with these guys?
If I think of all the noirs, there is something working where you're not rooting, for instance, in Double Indemnity for Fred McMurray to get caught. But as it turns out, they're unwinding as things go on. And same with The Asphalt Jungle. You know, you're I think it's because you're inside the crime, so to speak. You're not looking at it from society's point of view. You know, these people aren't good, you know, for society.
Right.
But, you know, it is a movie, and there's something about identifying with the criminals in this. Kubrick sort of alludes to it. I think more recent, it talks about the gangster and the artist. Society wants to see each of them fall. I'm not sure.
Oh, yes, yes.
I'm not so sure about the gangster part, at least in movies. But, why do we have the Godfather films? It's not like you're watching them to see them be captured, be brought before the Senate committee.
Right, right.
I think Kubrick was aware of this. I mean, I don't know how much you can make out of it, but he's definitely knows where the audience's bread is buttered in this, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. What about you, Mark? Has that been your experience as well with really empathizing with these men?
Yeah, well, as we talk about it, I am thinking that in almost every noir, including Double Indemnity, I tend to identify with the lead actor because they're usually charismatic, handsome. You understand they just want to do this one thing to get their lives right. Mm-hmm. And Sterling Hayden in this film seems like a good, just like J.C. Flippin's character describes him. He just had some bad breaks.
Yes.
He doesn't want anyone to get hurt. In the movie, unlike in the book, he just threatens Marie Windsor's character. That's for me, the emotional, that's why it pulls me along emotionally, because I am kind of half wanting him to succeed or at least get away.
Right. Yeah, that's always surprised me with Marie Windsor. Like when she shows up and she's spying on them, I thought he was going to kill her or kill Elijah Wood. And he's just like, look, there's going to be plenty of money later. Just mind your own business. And that was quite a risk. I mean, obviously it's such a, what's so interesting about this heist is that the plan is so perfect, but he just made a couple of mistakes, which was to have let her go, because then of course she told Vince Edwards about it and she's having an affair with him, and they plot to steal the money afterwards, which is unfortunately why all these guys get killed in that shootout. And at the end, you know, on that plane, I suppose didn't think that a luggage that large would be, he just thought that wouldn't be a problem, but that is a massive luggage, to bring on as a carry-on bag.
But Johnny Clay is thinking on his feet here. He needs Alicia Cook Jr. to let him in to get to the, what do you call it, the room with the money.
Well, that's true. Yeah. So
and,
he was
and in I think, I mean, even necessary. I think he discusses that with Sherry afterward, how important he is to the plan.
That's true.
And he sort of wants to pull, now he's thinking about pulling out and she's trying to get him back in.
Yes.
And that's a great scene because
yeah,
all of a sudden he probably, you know, he was offended. This past week we had Jan Harlan on our Zoom and he mentioned how jealousy was an important theme for Kubrick. It was an important thing and Eyes Wide Shut.
Yes, that's a good point. So I touched earlier on these use of lamps in the scene, which I love because it gave the feeling of, again, being in the spotlight or being interrogated in the police room, so to speak. Has anyone ever discussed why he did that? Or was that the intention behind it? Sort of they're all under the spotlight, so to speak.
The first time I saw it mentioned was in a book by Michel Simet in the 80s, where he sort of visually sort of discusses Kubrick films. And I think he has at least partly deals with the lighting and the intensity of the lighting. It is sort of startling though.
Yes. Yeah. What? How do you feel about that, Mark?
I actually noticed that kind of those lamps more when I was watching it without sound. And Kubrick was very keen on having practical lighting, meaning right, the lighting come from observable sources on the set.
Yes, which he did, of course, in Barry Lyndon later with the candlelight.
Yes. So I think this was his trying to work out how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's quite as good as later on, although I guess it fits right in with the noir dramatic lighting principles.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's very expressionistic. I thought that was, you know, really, really inventive. Just looking at the performances, I mean, clearly Kubrick liked noir movies, you know, because a lot of these actors were in so many noir films. I mean, Alicia Cook Jr., who really I think is an underrated actor. I mean, just his eyes alone speak volumes. I mean, it's amazing how much he, as you touched on, Robert, with his jealousy over you know, what his wife may be up to, cheating on him. Just the fear that he elicits in his eyes is extraordinary. And then, of course, I love this Colleen Gray because she's so, and as she was in some other film, North, but she's so angelic. She seems like someone who would not be involved with a guy like Sterling Hayden. But I it's sort of perfect casting because it makes you want him to get away with it even more just for this woman, you know, just so they can start afresh and you know, stop stealing, you know. And that's a very, you know, classic heist convention where the person is, this is their last job and the last, and they're not going to do it again. I'm curious, what are the standout performances from both of you in this one?
Timothy Carey stands out.
Yeah.
He's so great. There's a lot, I think, written about his sort of testiness as an actor. He was a total pain in the ass. You know, and he fits in perfectly here to give a, you know, this sort of psychotic assassin who's, you know, handling a puppy as they're discussing the job, you know. I mean, his presence in Paths of Glory is somewhat different, but in that movie, Kubrick didn't bother with French accents or anything.
Right.
And so it sort of legitimized, and his character sort of works out well there. But he is definitely a standout, just as a, you know, this guy who's totally, you know, sort of independent, I think, of people telling him what to do.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he was so unique. I mean, he just everything down to the way he looked, the way he talked. I've never seen anyone like him, you know, like he just has a vulnerability, but yet like he looks crazy, like he looks murderous, and he's so perfect for these kinds of parts. And I love the scene that he has at the racetrack in the parking lot with James Edwards, who, you know, he makes him feel that he's like trying to befriend him, and James Edwards appreciates it. And then, you know, he approaches him perhaps one too many times. And then of course he's so terrible and awful and racist towards him. And I love that once he gets killed, the shoehorn that James Edwards gave him is then, sorry, that wasn't a shoehorn. What do you call that?
A horseshoe.
Sorry. I got my shoes mixed up. The horseshoe, I love that good luck charm, the irony of that. Just now he's dead and it's on, you know, it's under the tire, under the car. That was so great. Yeah, he really is extraordinary. It's too bad that he was so difficult, and his stories are like legendary on, you know, One Eye Jacks, and he worked with Cassavetes a couple of times, killing him a Chinese bookie and Minnie and Moskowitz, and he's really something else. What about you, Mark? Is there some actors in this that you stand out performances that you are quite memorable for you?
Marie Windsor.
Yeah, she was great.
Yeah, again, when I was in college, I reacted to these things viscerally. So since I didn't like her character, I thought, she's so nasty.
Yeah.
I didn't like her. But now I can separate the two. And boy, is she so good with her deliveries.
She was great, yeah. Just down to those scenes again with Elijah Cook Jr., I thought were so, just to see his paranoia and jealousy build, and she knows exactly what she's doing, and that's exactly what she wants in order to, you know, get him to do the job, particularly because he's beginning to want to pull out of it. And I just thought that she was perhaps one of the most interesting femme fatales I've seen. I really liked her. I really liked her a lot. There's that really beautiful POV shot that he did once all the guys are killed in that shootout later on. And I just read this morning that apparently the DOP did not even want to do that because, you know, they were going to have to use handheld, and it was a bit shaky, as it was Elijah Cook Jr.'s POV to go to the door and leave. And, you know, that cinematographer was obviously extremely old-fashioned, and I just thought that's one of the greatest shots, because at first I'm not quite sure who got shot, and it's a little fuzzy, and again, you know, because Elijah Cook Jr., it's from his POV and what he's experiencing. But that was such a almost scary thing, that suddenly these guys who had all this money are now boom, gone. I'm curious if there's other, you know, trivia on the making of this film that interested you both the most because I know that this there was a lot of issues with UA and putting it out of order. And is there anything that you've read over the years that stand out to you?
Well, since you mentioned Lucien Ballard, the cinematographer,
right?
I had not heard that story before, and but it makes sense. And one of the things about Kubrick is he had made his own film fulfilling every role.
Right.
He had this background as a still photographer, and he had shot a lot of held in his documentaries that he did before features. So it was nothing to him to use a handheld. And actually, there's actually like three stories about Lucien Ballard. The second is, and Lucien Ballard was a great cinematographer, but he did things the Hollywood way.
Yeah.
And they sent him up to where the racetrack was to get some second unit shots. And they came back very boring. And Stanley felt they wouldn't add anything to the film. So he sent his friend Alexander Singer up there. And Singer did a lot of things to get good handheld shots where you're right in the action. And the last thing he did, and I don't know if it made it into the movie, he knew it was going to be the last thing he did, is he got out on the racetrack and lay down in front of the starting gate with his handheld camera so he could get all the horses coming towards him.
The Maverick filmmakers. I love it.
He was dragged away by security.
One thing that interested me, I ended up reading the book, Clean Break.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And it's interesting to see some of the changes made, regarding, and you know, the major one was the non-chronological order.
Right.
But, you know, there's some things that are similar, direct dialogue, and some not, but if you look at Kubrick's films in general, he mostly took and this was the first film he used another source, most of his films, if not all, were all from novels.
Yes.
And probably the one movie that wouldn't have been would be Napoleon, right, where he did like a year and a half of research. I don't think he was going to base that on any particular work, but it's an interesting thing to look through Kubrick's work and see how he adapted the films or had it with his screenwriters. I was looking up the Internet Movie Database. I think one of the last things in the trivia had to do with, apparently they were thinking of having Johnny Clay run after the money.
Oh.
He was going to be chopped up by a propeller.
Oh my God.
I mean, now, you know, cinematically, it sort of, if you see his body floating around with the money, it would have been interesting, but I think it turned out to be a little too difficult. I think people, in fact, it might have been the cinematographer said, but yeah, we just can't do this, you know?
Yeah.
And also it, when you see at the end how it ends.
I love that. He's powerless. Anyway. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he doesn't even try to run, you know. Then of course his bad luck continues. There's no cabs. And I love again that POV shot of those two cops just walking towards him slowly is really, really, really wonderful. It really is an extraordinary film. And I think it's obviously influenced the heist film in general so much. I mean, I think the most popular example is Reservoir Dogs, Tarantino's film. I mean, I think the killing to me is much more interesting because the characters you really feel for these guys. They're more humanized, and with Tarantino's are a little too cool for school. I mean, I'm not really a big fan of his movies to begin with. And I've said that before on this channel, and some people don't like that I say that, but you can certainly see the influence on his film and just so many heist films, particularly the element of, you know, hey, it's the last job. You know, you saw that in so many films to come. Thanks so much for coming. I really appreciate that you took the time to come and talk about Kubrick meets noir, so to speak, and The Killing, 1956. And where's the best place to listen to the podcast? It's pretty much on all of the various platforms, right? Apple and Spotify. And
just type in Kubrick's universe and yeah, you'll find it all the platforms.
Great.
Oh, and please, Stephen Rigg is the producer of it. And yeah, sadly, he couldn't be here for this interview, but
yeah,
it's really good. You'll find material there that it's you'll find nowhere else.
Oh, for sure. And if you're a Kubrick fan, it's like a candy store. It's just so many people he worked with. It's really, really, really great. And where can people find both of you online? Because I know that, you know, Robert, you mentioned you're a writer. Are you both on social media and have work online?
I have an Amazon site. I have about 15 books or so, five or six are Kindle.
Okay, great.
Some are copies, some are self-published, some are small publisher. I write novels, so mostly novels, fiction, and I have a thing called our daily film, where instead of a blog, I have about 70 articles or more on that. I'm not sure. I know I've referenced some of the articles in the IMDb for certain films, and Bright Lights Film Journal has sort of a large body of my film work. So all you have to do is go to the archive and authors and you'll find And it's, you know, more than Kubrick. I have a fair amount on Hitchcock.
Right.
And media movies tend to be my sort of interest, like things like King of Comedy and The Truman Show movie. is becoming a major element in my life.
Great. Well, I'll leave the link. Send me the links, and I'll put them in the description box if people want to read the writings of Robert Castle. And Mark, how about you? Anything people can find online?
Yeah, I have two plugs. I'll send you the links.
Okay.
Please join the Stanley Kubrick Appreciation Society on Facebook. There's a lot of interesting people on there and a lot of good posts. I'm an admin on that site. And then we'd really love it if you would join me and Robert on our weekly Zooms about Kubrick. And you can find them by searching on Stanley Kubrick Meetup, NYC. Oh. And I'll send you the main link for that.
Okay,
yeah, great. We're always looking for new regulars.
Yes. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, please do. And I'll leave the links in the description box below. And for those of you watching on YouTube, this YouTube channel, there's also an audio version podcast. It's on all of the various platforms. If you just Google Robert Bellissimo at the movies, but there's much more on the YouTube channel. So if you're listening to this now, go over to the YouTube channel if you want to watch and or listen to more. And if this is your first time on the YouTube channel, please consider subscribing by pressing the Robert Bellissimo at the Movies logo. You'll see it floating above my head here to your top left. Just click on that and then click the bell in order to get a notification every time I release a new video or when I go live. Gentlemen, thanks again. Please come again to do more Kubrick or anything else, because I know you're big film buffs in general. So thanks again, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you. We'll talk soon.